Hello and welcome. I'm your host Pooja Sarkar and you're listening to the podcast From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. I wanted to thank all of you for being a part of our journey, and I also wanted to let you all know that we are now available on Spotify and Stitcher. Please find us there apart from our website. Today, on April 15th, as I record this podcast, 20 lakh people across the globe have been infected by the coronavirus and 1.26 lakh people have already died. Closer home in India, we have 11,555 cases, of which 396 people have lost their lives, especially the elder citizens. While India has tested 2.45 lakh people, one can't help but gasp at the fact that 177 tests per 1 million population has been done till now. When we compare it with other global economies, it is fairly less. There is a book that has recently been launched by Penguin. It is called The Coronavirus: What You Need to Know About the Global Pandemic, written by three doctors, Dr. Swapnil Parikh, Dr. Rajesh Parikh, and Mahira Desai. And I decided that it's time we speak to them. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
My first question is, in your book, you've written the fact that in 2007, there was a report in a medical journal by researchers of the University of Hong Kong who termed coronavirus a time bomb. And there are various type of viruses that they're coronavirus. I mean, you have made partitions in the book about each type of viruses. Could you take us through what really happened over the last 13 years? What have we been doing about the fact that we know that coronavirus has been there?
This report appeared, as you pointed out, in 2007. And at that time, you know, I remember being a little startled by the language in the abstract. The journal was Clinical Microbiology Reviews, and the article was titled Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus as an Agent of Emerging, and mind you, Re-emerging Infection. And the authors, Vincent Cheng et al, used a word time bomb, and that made it into the abstract of the article, which is a little unusual because, scientific journals generally understated. And so it seemed a little unusual, but now retrospectively one realizes that the author and the editors of the journal clearly knew what they're talking about. So since then, some things have happened and a lot hasn't happened. What hasn't happened is that we have not been prepared for this. There are article and subsequent reports that emerged and subsequent lessons that we learned from, other pandemics have to some extent been ignored. We are not prepared adequately. In a sense, one can never be prepared adequately, but we've not taken the measures. And by we, I don't mean us as a country. I'm talking about society. Adequate measures were not taken. Funding was not given. Priorities were not given. The Western countries continued to harbor the delusion, I might say, that infective diseases were priorities in the so-called third world, and that their priorities were really illnesses like diabetes, hypertension, cancer, maybe Alzheimer's, depression. And so there was a disproportionate amount of funding that was diverted from dealing with a pandemic to dealing with their immediate problems. That in a nutshell is what has happened over the past few years.
Mm-hmm. Coming to the part, let's focusing on India, there is a raging debate about, community transmission. Some agree, some disagree. Then we have this new term called cluster transmission. Could you take the listeners through what really is happening? A, we have seen cases grow significantly. Are we moving according to the pattern that we are supposed to move? How far are we in the ecosystem? By when do we believe that it's going to flatten out? What is really happening? Because everybody has a million questions around, are we safe enough? What do we do? So if you could take us through some of these answers.
I'll start with the first one and then we'll let Mahira take over some of the others. So the first one was related to community transmission. It's a moot point. It's important, but doesn't have a huge big bearing on the actions. All our actions that have begun indicate what we would do if there was community transmission. Yet at the same time, some people maintain that there is no community transmission. Others maintain that we are already on the verge of a community transmission, and there are still others who maintain community transmission started maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. So these are different perspectives. But what do we mean by community transmission? That's important. You know, we need to define our terms so that we can then discuss what needs to be done or even what's actually happening. We talk of community transmission when we see cases emerge in which either there has been no history of travel to an area where there is a epidemic or a pandemic, or there is no history of the person who is now infected having come in contact with somebody who has a travel history. So if these two criteria are fulfilled, then you have community transmission. Myra, would you like to take over?
Yeah, sure. So also to add that the term cluster transmission is usually used when they're trying to say that it's restricted. There is community transmission restricted to a specific zone or an area. And in a country like India, where it becomes hard to contain because anyway, especially in the populated cities, people are living very close to each other. So it becomes very hard to avoid this transmission from happening. If I can also just add, Dr. Mark Lipsitch, who is an international epidemiologist and a world leader on the matter, has commented that roughly about, conservatively, 20 to 60% of the world population is likely to contract this illness at some point or the other. So, like Dr. Parikh was mentioning, the idea is the action that we are going to take. We have scaled up testing. And it's going to be a four-pronged approach where people take the precautionary measures. You do scale up testing. You're looking at identifying and isolating the confirmed cases and providing treatment for them. The testing is scaled up, but I think we need to do a lot more on that front, because if we can't identify them, and then it's going to be hard to take the following steps that are required.
True. But I just wanted to understand, you know, how would you rate India's testing strategy? And, you know, what are the kind of bottlenecks that we are seeing in terms of the number of testing? Our testing numbers are pretty low. As you mentioned in your book also, people in South Korea, they come into their car, they get the testing done, and they leave in their car. They're not even getting out of the car. I know we are very, very far away from that kind of a concept. But in India, what are the kind of testings that we are doing? How far are we in terms of getting testing done? And second, everybody is now talking about rapid testing. Do we have that many test kits in India to first test? And second, if we have, then which are the places that we are seeing more traction in terms of test kits being available?
Well, we don't have enough test kits, but we are in the process of acquiring them. In all fairness, you know, there is a limitation to the analogy between South Korea and India. That's a homogenous country. It's a small country. It's technologically more advanced than us. The literacy rates are different over there. You know, we may not be able to reach that level of testing. But certainly it is being scaled up dramatically. You know, from doing maybe less than 100 a day, we are now, I think, nearly at 20,000 a day. Maybe between 16,000 and 20,000. So we are ramping it up. There are, of course, issues. You have to get reliable test kits. Let us not forget that the test kits that you know, China sent to Italy and many other countries were completely defective. So the kits need to be standardized because otherwise you get a false sense of security. If the kit is not good enough, somebody will show up negative. As it is, in the best of circumstances, the commonly used test, RT-PCR, has a certain negative rate. That's called the sensitivity of the test, how many false negatives there are. So there are issues, but they are not insurmountable. And I think the Indian government is doing the best it can to get around it. We got a little late into the act, but I think as we ramp it up, we'll see a clearer picture. As to your other question about, you know, doctors not rushing in with the tests, that clearly was because there was a paucity of test kits. As more kits become available, then of course we will see tests being done. And the third issue, which I might kind of link to your first question, is you're talking about the difficulty when a patient goes with symptoms to a hospital. Let us not forget the community testing. We need to do that. We need to do this in asymptomatic patients. Because a Chinese study conducted on 44,454 patients indicated that 81% of people who harbor the virus and who can potentially therefore spread it have either no symptoms or very mild symptoms. They may not even realize that they have a symptom. It might just be an occasional cough or tiredness or, you know, cold. So, now that becomes dangerous because if you're not testing enough. So far from testing the people who walk in asking for tests, we need to be out in the community testing people who are asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm. If I may just add, South Korea has released numbers saying that 20% of all of their cases that they have confirmed as positive on laboratory tests are completely asymptomatic. So not even mild, just absolutely asymptomatic from the moment they got infected until their test results were negative as well. And in terms of the lab, the laboratory testing, see, the X-rays are helpful and they are chest PT is being used, CT is being used as identification and it is fairly accurate. We have the RT-PCR test as well. And the other third blood test that you were mentioning are serological tests, which are only now being considered and initiated in the country. However, for the most common type of test, which is the RT-PCR, it's a fairly easy test to administer. And with about 50 to 70% of accuracy, it's something that we can scale up. We have a lab in Pune, My Labs, which has stated a few weeks ago that their capacity currently for creating these lab kits, even if you're just looking at Indian resources, is about 20,000 lab kits a day is what they can create. And they said that if required, they could scale that up to 50,000. So I think we are already considering all these options and maximizing them. And I think a few weeks in, hopefully, we should see a lot more testing happening.
True. Myra, you mentioned Dr. Lipsitch, who's obviously a professor of entomology at Harvard University. You guys also talk about him in the book where you say that he said that COVID-19 may disappear for a few years, but it may return in 2025. Why and how do we prepare for a tomorrow like that?
Vaccinations, that's what we're looking at. And in fact, even more recently, experts are saying currently that until we find a vaccine, it seems like it may be harder to stop the transmission of this virus because of how easily it spreads. So I think getting a vaccine would be an answer. They're also looking at a vaccine for multiple viruses. So if something like that comes up, then that's great for humanity. But until then, we wait. And then, of course, the virus itself keeps mutating and modifying itself so as to adapt and reinfect people. So I think the idea of it coming back after a few years is that if the virus is able to mutate, then it again regains the ability to reinfect individuals.
True. There's one thing I wanted to understand. You also talk about in the book that social distancing strategies are a means to buy more time to build our healthcare infrastructure. And the Prime Minister has extended the lockdown till May 3rd. It will buy us time, but how far are we from being really prepared to take on this war?
Nobody can be adequately prepared, Peter. No one can be fully prepared. Okay. Remember, the virus is always one step ahead of us. We are following the virus. Metaphorical sense, the virus seems to have understood humans far, far better than humans have understood the virus. So we have to continue our efforts. Flattening the curve has now become a cliche. You know, everybody talks about it. We brought up this compelling need almost 2 months ago. Myra will perhaps talk a bit about the social distance, physical distance kind of paradigm.
Yeah, sure. So again, when we say social distancing, we've even mentioned that in the book multiple times, the idea is not that people stay disconnected, but it's actually physical distance from each other, that we need to maintain a certain separation. Currently, behavioral strategies are the most effective way to slow down, or what you say, cut the chain of transmission that is there. And in that, let's be clear that we are talking about physical distance, not necessarily social distance from each other. We're all socially connected. Technology is coming to use like never before, and that seems there to stay. So that makes also a very big psychological shift in every individual's mind, that you're not alone in this. You may be physically apart, but still together. Why is this understanding so important? Because researchers all over the world, coming to the second aspect that you were mentioning about scaling up our facilities and how much is going to be enough, I don't have a number to that. But when every single case that comes up, and every critical case finds a doctor who can attend to them, finds a hospital bed if required, finds an ICU admission when required, that's when you know it's enough. And that we're anyway struggling in a country like India with a population of over 138 crores, that's something we were struggling even before we were hit with this pandemic.
Let's talk about Maharashtra, because Maharashtra has seen the highest number of cases. How do we deal with the situation in places like Mumbai, which is seeing the highest number of cases? Also, because you have slums, there is Dharavi, there is Kolivara. We have these sudden clusters where people really live in very close proximity. How do we deal with these kind of situations? And second, our medical infrastructure is really at its tipping point at this point in time, with so many patients coming in. How are people, how is the medical fraternity looking at it, and what are the measures that are being taken to take care of everyone who's coming in?
Okay, Pooja. So, in the beginning, we spoke of absolute numbers versus relative numbers. Look at the population of Mumbai. Other than the fact that there's overcrowding and people are staying in slums, the population density is such, the sheer numbers of people in the city are such, that naturally you'll get a high number of cases. So again, we've got to look at these cases in the context of how many per million. Maharashtra itself is a very highly populated state, and so it's not astonishing that there are more cases in Maharashtra than, say, in a smaller state like Meghalaya. Having said that, your second question was, so what do we do? Well, I think we have to give our poor people who do not have the luxury of social distance in their crowded houses a clear message. On the one hand, everybody from the Prime Minister downwards to doctors to everybody now is exhorting people to maintain social distance or physical distance or whatever you call it. And yet, when people who live, 8 and 10 to a small room step out on the road to get away from each other, there is brutality, there's police brutality, and people are attacking them with sticks, making them, do silly punishments like sit-ups. So what do these people do? I mean, they're getting two conflicting messages. And I think we need to sort that out first. I believe that's already being done. About 2 weeks ago, we recommended, let people out on the streets as long as they maintain distance from each other, and as long as they're not just wandering around for pleasure or for shopping. Let people come out. It's not raining right now. If people want to sleep out on the streets and maintain distance from each other, I mean, that's a basic compassionate measure that we should allow, rather than, herding them together. And I'm, not even getting into the tragedy of our migrant workers.
If I can just add to that, in Maharashtra, at least I'm aware that over 3,500 relief camps for the migrant workers, for homeless people, have been created. A lot of public places like stadiums and the NSCI dome, which we have, they've opened them up as quarantine facilities. They've created shelters wherever available, even providing food and basic essentials to them.
Yeah, what about the public gardens? I mean, nobody's walking there anyway. There are huge gardens, huge open areas in the city. Why not just demarcate, spaces so that people stay adequately away from each other?
Right. Especially also a lot of schools, which are closed right now. Schools, facilities. can be opened up, colleges can be opened up, because they have the space to provide right now.
This one, in the end, towards the end, you, in your book, you write about the fact that, you know, according to the World Bank, each new infection, moderately or severe or worse, is estimated to cost nearly $570 million or nearly 0.7% of global income. What really could be the impact of COVID-19? Also, do you think WHO took a little longer to call it a pandemic? Shouldn't have things been done a little early?
Regarding the economic toll, that's how much it usually takes. This is going to be worse, definitely. Recent estimates as recently as about a week ago stated that we're already anticipating a $4 to $5 trillion US dollar economic hit because of the COVID pandemic. And definitely sectors like tourism, healthcare costs, personal individual costs are going to be seen, and luxury goods are going to see the maximum hit on this front. So that's the estimate so far. How the virus moves and changes the dynamics over the next couple of months, these numbers are constantly going to be revised. As of 1 month back, the estimate was 1 trillion. It's already moved to 4 to 5 trillion.
All right. So about the WHO moving slow, again, in January, early February, we warned of this possibility that the WHO will hesitate to declare it a pandemic. And you may have seen in our book, I was just leafing through it, it's right in the beginning on page 10 of the book, that we talked about how in the 2009 swine flu pandemic, of which I spoke a little earlier, the WHO was quick and appropriately quick to declare it a pandemic. And, vaccines were scaled up. And then the pandemic settled down earlier than expected. And suddenly there was criticism of the WHO. The British Medical Journal published an editorial revealing that some of the advisors of the WHO were also advisors to pharmaceutical companies which develop these vaccines. Now, that's not unusual. You know, you can be an advisor to more than, one organization. So there were allegations that the WHO is in a hurry to declare swine flu a pandemic, so that the pharmaceutical industry could benefit from it. However, Margaret Chan, who was the Margaret Chan, who was the Director General of the WHO, wrote a letter to the British Medical Journal pointing out that the criteria for declaring a pandemic are fairly well defined. They are based on virological and epidemiological criteria, and that it's not easy at all to bend this criteria, no matter what you want to do. So with that history, when we talk of the history of pandemics, 2 months ago, we expressed the apprehension that because of those allegations, because of what WHO went through that time, they would probably be hesitant in declaring the current epidemic, as it was so called, a pandemic. And we again cautioned against that of now overreacting to earlier criticism. Very clearly, those fears were not unfounded. The WHO waited a long, long time to declare it a pandemic. I don't know what the compulsions were. One shouldn't assume that it was what we thought it might be. But they clearly waited too long. The whole world was calling it a pandemic, and WHO, who should be first of the block, were actually last in calling it a pandemic.
True. And before you guys go away, the last question would be on by when do you think we would be good enough to come back on the roads?
That's a question I don't think anybody has an appropriate answer for.
Thank you so much for your time. I know you guys are very busy, but thank you so much for being on the podcast.